All the Rage with John Bowd. www.traxfm.org.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome to All the Rage. Thank you for your company, for your listening. And as ever these days, we always send out as much love and solidarity all around the world in these very difficult and troubling times. I don't know how much that's of any worth to you, but you've got it anyway. Now, I'm very delighted to say that, yet again, we are accompanied by a guest this week. But not only a guest, our very first interviewee is back. The All the Rage OG guest, as it were. We are once again speaking to Pamela Fitzpatrick. Hello, how are you?
Hi, John. It's great to be back. I'm fine. Tired with COVID like everybody else, but I'm fine, thanks.
Not literally with COVID, I hope.
No, I've managed to avoid it. I've been very lucky because Harrow's been very badly affected by COVID. We're in the top five, I think, boroughs that have been most affected. So been difficult because, you know of lots of people who have been affected, who've lost loved ones, and through the law centre, the cases we've dealt with, it's been really difficult for the community.
Yeah, I can imagine. And also, one of the issues we have with this kind of thing is a government that's very keen on blaming the victims, which you've had a lot of. And I've noticed that in a lot of areas where there've been, well, certain areas where there've been outbreaks, especially from this government, certain areas have a certain, should we say, ethnic breakdown, tend to get a lot of, well, you know, this is somehow your fault for doing this or for eating together or and blissfully ignoring things like all of the white people running around the streets on VE Day and stuff like that. Quite a lot.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the kind of factors that have had most impact are things like poverty and poor housing and Harrow. It's classic. If you'd asked the law centre, you know, that there's this virus coming that will impact on people in poor housing and in poverty and in kind of precarious work, we would have said it's going to have a terrible impact in Harrow because Harrow has such a low level of council housing and people are packed into private rented sector accommodation that's too expensive. So they're really overcrowded and it's in poor condition. And then you have lots of people who are working either in things like the NHS, but a lot of people in Harrow work as cab drivers or in shops or building sites, in places where they're kind of facing with the public quite a lot, so would be at risk. But housing and poverty seem to be far more a risk than anything else. But the issue about the kind of racist element has been raised with me because you'll remember that there were lots of protests around Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And at one of the events that I attended, a number of people said to me that they were worried that they would be accused of spreading the virus by attending an event like that, and also contrasted what they were doing by, you know, making sure there was good social distance and everybody had masks and everything to people just turning up at the beaches who there was no criticism whatsoever.
Indeed. And I would just put in my two pennies worth on that subject, say to anyone, particularly from a poorer area, or certainly anyone who's a member of an ethnic minority, unfortunately, the people who are going to accuse you of spreading this disease are going to accuse you of it if you happen to sit in your living room for 4 months, because that's their agenda. The media in this country and our political system are so utterly broken. With the already existing housing crisis, and with a situation that I think is going to get substantially worse with the increasing of more poverty, more joblessness, etc. in this country. Again, you're not going to get a lot from the media, which is why you should come and listen to All the Rage, because this evening we are going to try and give you a bit more information about your rights, about preparation, if you like, for upcoming crises. And we're going to talk about a few bits there, and Pamela's going to help us out with some good examples from her job working at the Harrow Law Centre. So let's begin with, just before we went live, we were talking about evictions, and you had some very pertinent information about that situation.
Yes, I mean, you've probably all heard that evictions have been banned at least until the end of August. But it's not really our experience. It's true that the courts are not operating to evict people. But at the Law Centre, what we found is that instead of going through the legal process, we've had a real spike in illegal evictions, which means that the landlord is just changing the locks or just throwing people out or just telling them to go by intimidating them. We've had a lot of cases like that. So to give you an example of one and how things go wrong, we had a quite vulnerable man who had been told to leave his property. He was a victim of the lockdown and COVID because his job, he'd been laid off from his job. He'd applied for universal credit, but like so many people, was waiting weeks and weeks for the first payment. So he'd fallen into arrears with his rent. And the landlord wasn't understanding and told him to leave. So he sought some advice initially and was told, well, the landlord can't do that, so you can just call the police because it's a criminal offence if the landlord tries to evict you. So he followed this advice and the police came and the police told him to hand back the keys. So rather than telling the landlord that this was a criminal matter if he forced the eviction, the tenant was the one being told to give back the keys. So he contacted the council, who advised him to contact the Law Centre, and we got involved and we contacted the landlord and explained the legal position and that if he tried to evict the tenant, that we would then go to court to try to get the tenant back into the property and would seek damages for the tenant. So we'd also contacted the council to make sure that if he was evicted, there would be somewhere for him to go that night. However, it was a Friday evening and we thought all was resolved until 7 o'clock, 7:30. I think I got a call from one of my colleagues, the housing solicitor who'd been dealing with it, to say indeed the landlord had evicted the tenant illegally, fully in the knowledge that it was illegal and a criminal offence. So Friday evening, nothing we could do till the Monday. But on the Monday, we got into court and we got an injunction and we got the keys back for the tenant. And we got the tenant back into his property. And we also secured some damages of about a few £1,000 for the tenant. So that was quite a good result. But what I would like, and we have asked the council to do, is to prosecute the landlord because they have the power to do that. And if they make an example of landlords who behave like this, then other landlords will be less willing to do so. And that's just one case, and we've had many like that. And it's more difficult for people to get advice because a lot of the agencies have got reduced services and not operating in the same way. I'm just pleased that he was referred to us because there may be many more that are not. It was another case of a couple, same thing, had been thrown out, was sleeping in a park in South Harrow. Other people who've been asked to leave their property because they're NHS workers or minicab drivers and the landlord feared that they would spread COVID. So my worry is what happens to the people who don't advice. So they left on the street and they lose their home and then the difficulty of finding anywhere else at this time. So the evictions officially can start again at the end of August and many are asking for an extension of the ban on evictions because we do predict that there'll be a sudden influx of applications to the court to evict tenants who are in rent arrears because it's inevitable if they've lost their job and they've had to rely on benefit, that benefit won't necessarily cover all their rent and they'll find themselves in arrears. So it's a sad state for local people here in Harrow, but also I suspect the same is replicated throughout London.
Yeah, and probably the wider country too. I just want to spin back to something you mentioned there of the just general uselessness of the police. Is it another case here where you, or have you found policemen showing up at a scene when they don't really know what the law is?
Yes, and I took it up with a senior police officer afterwards who said it really wasn't within their jurisdiction. It is, and we are now producing a letter that we'll publicise to go to the police to explain you know, exactly what the law is. You know, in some areas, police can be overzealous in the use of the law, and in this, which they'd be doing a real good, they don't seem to know that a criminal offence is being committed. So, and just by telling a landlord, that could have a huge impact, because usually a landlord will, you would hope, would abide by what the police are saying. But if they contradict what the council or an advice worker has told the tenant, who are they going to believe? Or, you know, they're going to be intimidated as well, probably, and just believe that they have to hand back the keys.
Yeah, and that intimidation is a very, very important point to make. I think that's how both the police and landlords, among other people, get their way a lot of the time. It's simply the notion that we don't know our rights, and we are likely to be, you know, intimidated by those with the smartest suit, should we say.
And Harrow's particularly prone to this because we have such a lack of social housing. So poorer people who would perhaps in another borough be in council housing or housing association property are in private rented accommodation in Harrow generally. So they're much more prone to eviction than they would be in social housing.
Yes, very much a troublesome case. Okay, so where will information on housing law, where could someone find that, you know, kind of as quick as possible? Where, with any websites or anything from the council they could get?
Yeah, so what they can do, the Law Centre has produced some information, quite basic information about housing. And the problem is it changes so frequently, things that you don't want to mislead people. So it's always best to get advice if you can. So to contact either the Citizens Advice Bureau in Harrow or the Law Centre, but also Shelter, the national charity, has quite a very good website with lots of information and advice guides on. So that's always a good place to go as well.
Yeah.
But often, even though you know what your rights are, trying to enforce them is another matter. So, you know, this tenant had been told that it's illegal to have him evicted, and yet nobody abided by what the law was supposed to be. So it's very hard for him on his own to actually do something. Whereas if you've got a solicitor on board who can take on your case, you are in so much more powerful a position. Well, I was just going to say other examples that we've had during COVID, which have been really sad, are people who've lost relatives to COVID, and the landlords have wanted to just chuck out the belongings of the person who's died, and yet relatives haven't been able to come to collect the belongings because they were self-isolating or ill themselves. And again, the Law Centre got involved in quite a few of those cases, but it is really sad to think that you've lost a loved one, and then you might have lost many of the kind of things that you'd have, you know, treasured memories, photographs and things like that of the person.
You spoke about being defended, you know, obviously with the lawyer, and maybe this is going to be a great advert for the Law Centre. How can someone get a lawyer when they've got no money?
Well, if they qualify for legal aid, then they can get a lawyer. So that's crucial. But so many law firms no longer do legal aid work. So in Harrow, I think there's only, apart from the Law Centre, I think there's two firms that do any type of social welfare law. So it's few and far between, and they're all very, very busy. So if the problem is, it's not just paying for a lawyer. If you go to court, you risk having to pay the other side's costs as well. And also, you need somebody who knows what they're doing, because you don't want somebody who's going to just say, yes, 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 go to court, and then you haven't got a case really to win, and you've spent quite a lot of money that you probably don't have. So that's why it's crucial having sort of legal aid lawyers. Have to say that the cutoff level for legal aid is very low, so if you're working, you probably don't qualify.
Right.
At the Law Centre, we do try to do some work that's not solely legal aid work. But if somebody's going to court, you are at risk then, of cost. But to give you an example, we had some time ago, this was before COVID, but we had an 18-year-old who lived in a housing association property, and his mum had died, and his father, who didn't live with him then, succeeded the tenancy to look after him when he was about 13 or 14, I think. And he got up one morning when he was 18 and found his dad dead on the sofa. And the housing association, instead of trying to be sympathetic and supportive of an 18-year-old left in that situation, tried to evict him. And they tried to evict him on the basis that he couldn't succeed the tenancy because there'd already been one succession, and you're not allowed two successions of a tenancy. So that young man didn't qualify for legal aid because he was working, even though his earnings were very low. And so he wouldn't have got a private practice solicitor to help him. And really, a generalist agency wouldn't have had the expertise to help. So we took on that case because we thought it was important. And one of our housing solicitors spotted something within the tenancy agreement that did allow a second succession. So we argued that and were successful. And so in theory, he was then allowed to stay in the property. Apart from the Housing Association then tried a second route to get rid of him by saying that he was in arrears with the tenancy now. The reason he was in arrears is because they hadn't granted the tenancy to him. So he wasn't able to claim housing benefit or even pay anything because they wouldn't have accepted it. So when we were successful in getting the succession of tenancy, they backdated it, created arrears, and then tried to evict him again. On that, I have to say the council were really helpful and stepped in with a discretionary housing payment because obviously they did feel sympathetic, but we were able to put that case on his behalf. So he's now kind of living happily in his flat and continued in his job, of which he was an apprentice, and has now qualified. And it's interesting because I was interviewed by somebody for a book that they were writing, and they had interviewed quite a lot of people. When I told her that story, she told me that it was a real sort of sliding doors moment, because she'd interviewed another man who was in his 50s, and a very similar thing had happened, but he was evicted and he was street homeless and he became alcoholic and his life kind of spiraled downwards. And it just shows what a difference it can make to have intervention by somebody who knows what they're doing to secure your rights. And of course, if you've got loads of money, you can always do that. You can always afford a lawyer. But if you're poor or have a middle income, you can't.
Yeah. And once again, a very good example of why we have law centres. Where would I, let's say someone were to be interested in their spare time, at least maybe doing a bit of law study.
You're probably not going to want me to say this, but I always do, that it's kind of a little knowledge is dangerous.
I agree with you. Yeah.
We so often see people who've been helped and they've made it worse, not necessarily on housing, but on benefits and all sorts of things. And then it's harder to unpick the mess because somebody might have missed something. And often people don't present with one problem. It's kind of multiple interrelated problems and you've got to sort them all out. So I would say the best thing you can do is to get somebody to decent advice, really. And that's not always possible. But if it was housing, for example, really basic advice is if your landlord tells you to go, don't go. Just get advice, you know, always. Usually a landlord can't just evict you without a court order. So that would be generalist good advice that you can give. Always turn up to any court hearings, you know, even if the council or somebody else tells you you don't need to be there, it's really important to make sure you're heard. More than that, if somebody's advising, you may well miss something that leads to a kind of quite poor outcome for the client. If you want to get involved in advice, I would say that it's probably best to do it through some formal structure that has kind of checks and balances. So the obvious one is the Citizens Advice Bureau, but it works at a kind of lower level, I suppose, than a law centre. But for example, in a law centre, we don't allow even kind of law students to advise the public. We're heavily regulated, so you can only advise if you're kind of qualified to do so. So yeah, that would be my advice. Get them to somebody who has expertise in that area, really.
I was going to say, actually, there was a couple of things on YouTube talking about UK housing law. Although I would say that was very much the realm of the amateur. It can't hurt to at least watch stuff like that and just learn.
Exactly, because it might be that you'll pick up things, you know, even as I said, people often will ring the law centre and say, my landlord's told me to go tonight. And you would say, no, don't, you know, you stay put, don't go. If they change the locks, you call the police and tell them it's an eviction. That kind of basic things can really help people because they may not know that. The other things are around housing, you know, applying for housing to the council. There's a lot of myths around that, you know, but applying for housing, if you're offered accommodation that's deemed to be suitable and you turn it down, you can the council can discharge its duty towards you. So it's really important that you get advice before turning down any accommodation. And if you're arguing it's unsuitable, there's got to be specific grounds for that. And that's a mistake people make quite often. So, and then they find that the council's discharged their duty.
Oh, well, thank you for that. Before we move on, I just want to sum up this section. Just to recap, if you are evicted, it may be an illegal eviction. So you may be, if you're told to go simply by a landlord, for instance, that's not right. So please contact a law centre where you can, which doesn't cost you any money.
Yeah.
Landlords are not able to just evict you. Get advice before you're told to leave. Always show up for any court appearances. And if you can't access the law centre, there is some law info at the Citizens Advice Bureau where possible.
The council does have a housing advice centre. So, you know, they should be intervening in some situations like this. The other thing I get loads of calls from residents in as a councillor as well. So contact your local councillors to tell them. I mean, some are more effective than others, but that is another route that you can try to get help if you're not able to access kind of legal advice. I'll just add, John, that with housing, we're quite aware that a lot of it is there's a need for campaigning as well as just advising on individual rights to improve things for people. So we are seeking funding currently to employ a housing campaigns worker, which we hope to have by the end of this year, start of next year, because mobilising people, getting them to understand what their rights are, because it's not always about legal action. In some cases, people can take cases to the ombudsman.
Okay.
So, for example, in Harrow, we had cases of people being left in bed and breakfast for months and months when the guidance is you shouldn't be in bed and breakfast for more than 6 weeks, and it can have a hugely detrimental impact on families if you're packed into a B&B. So other things that the Law Centre does is assist people bring complaints to the Ombudsman. And the Ombudsman does have quite wide-ranging powers to force councils or indeed housing associations to take action and to change their policies, behaviour, etc.
I just want to ask a couple of questions about homelessness, and again, specifically to the Harrow area. Again, I'll just illustrate this for any listeners who aren't familiar with it. There was a big call, a lot of fuss earlier on in the COVID-19 pandemic during the lockdown period when we were told that many homeless people were being brought in from the streets to make them less vulnerable. They were being given, supposedly being in access to shelters, certain hotels that weren't open at the time were being used. However, we are, of course, wherever you go, you still see people in the street. And there could be a number of reasons for them, depending on what time of day you see them. But I was just wondering, are we seeing a return to the streets right now?
I think, as you said, there's been people on the streets throughout lockdown, really, since COVID. I have to say on this, the council have been quite good because I would come across quite a lot of people would contact me about street homeless people or other issues. And if I got in contact with the council, they would offer accommodation to them. Generally, it wasn't as problematic as it normally is. So it was much better. And it does start to make you wonder, why can't we do this all year round? Why do we have this? You know, but there will always be some people who won't go into hostels. And sometimes it's because they're frightened of where they're being sent. And the accommodation over the lockdown period was probably slightly better because they may have been in hotel accommodation, etc. But you will get some people. Some of the people you see during the day are probably people who have got somewhere to stay but are on the streets during the day. That would be some. But you will still get some people who are definitely homeless and don't want to be accommodated in the places that they can be accommodated. That's the problem. I don't think this happened during lockdown, but what does happen quite often is if somebody is homeless and the council accommodates them, they'll accommodate them out of borough. And when I say out of borough, I mean far out of borough. So if you're being sent to Birmingham, you may think, oh, no, actually, I don't want to go to Birmingham. You say no, and then the council discharges its duty towards you. So that wasn't happening during lockdown. There may have been some cases that fell through the net, but generally that wasn't happening.
Yeah, because I'm very concerned about this on a personal level too, which is that I feel like we're seeing... what I worry about is seeing people just kind of quietly being shoved out.
Yeah, I'm sure that's happening. The council, I'm not sure they are pushing them out yet, but I think that will come. I hope not, and I'd obviously raise kind of objections about that. But I think also the people you don't realise, so people have an image of homeless people as being the kind of alcoholic or drug-dependent single man that's on the street. But actually, more often, it's not. It's different people who are hidden. So yeah. Quite often, we've seen families who've been street homeless. And in one case, again, it was before COVID lockdown, but, you know, I've had a head teacher ring me furious because a family, kids had turned up to school and they'd been walking the streets all night, basically, been street homeless. And that should never happen, never. But it does. And we see that quite often, but people don't think of that as somebody who's homeless. And also... families sleeping in cars. So we've had a family with a three-month-old baby sleeping in a car, which is pretty awful in a very wealthy economy that we are, despite what we're told all the time. But yeah, I agree. I mean, I have to say, I'm less out on the streets at the moment, so I probably see less, to be honest, you know, but it's something we've got to keep an eye on and make sure that we're not having a return to the streets, because it's, you know, it should be treated as a health issue. Not a financial issue. And I do have to say, a lot of the homelessness, and this will continue, is because so many people are excluded from the benefit system because of residence conditions, such as the right to reside test. So that has a huge impact, and habitual residence test, mainly on EU nationals, but it can affect British citizens who've returned to the UK as well. Which excludes them from access to most means-tested benefits and also to housing. So that's a really good example of why we've had such an increase of homeless EU nationals. It's a creation basically by government that we could change if we wanted to, just change the benefit system.
Are you seeing any issues here, or does the Law Centre kind of provide anything in regards to refugee or migrant rights and stuff, or is that a different...
No, we do. No, we have a whole immigration team. So it's one of the busiest parts of the Law Centre. So the only work we do for immigration is asylum, trafficking and modern day slavery and the rights of EU nationals. So we see a huge amount of it. And I always think these papers, I mean, the video I saw, the news filming these boats coming in was absolutely disgraceful. They were treating it like sort of reality TV rather than knowing what those people had been through, you know, particularly if they're coming somewhere like Syria. And what I would say is I wish they could hear the stories or listen to the stories that we tell of our clients and the experiences they've been through to get here, basically. And to get here, they get on a boat because it's safer to get on that dangerous boat than to stay where they are. And if they don't realise that, I just, you know, what is the point of talking to these people, really? But the cases, we've had amazing cases. We had one case of a young boy who's an asylum seeker, traumatised. 2 years it had taken him to get to the UK, and that's not uncommon. And some people have walked across countries to get here. And they come because they may have relatives or some other connection, or because they believe in British justice and all sorts of things like that. But anyway, often it's because of family here who are also refugees. And it's some kind of family reunion. But we had a young boy who was completely traumatised, couldn't stop crying. And our immigration solicitor recognised that the town that he was from was a very small town, with only a very small community. And he remembers that he'd also assisted another person from that same town and many years before. And so our immigration solicitor asked the young boy whether he had any relatives. And he said, yes, he had an uncle, but he hadn't seen him since he was a small boy. And this boy was distraught because he was in a foreign land on his own, having been through terrible things. Anyway, immigration lawyer sort of questioned him more and talked about sort of, you know, his family, then realised that the person that we'd assisted some years before was his uncle, the boy's uncle. And we were able to reunite the boy with his uncle on the phone. And it was absolutely amazing, actually. And in another case, we had a woman who had to flee her country. A baby was taken from her and they were separated. And she had come to the UK as a refugee and she granted refugee status, but she hadn't seen her child. I think it was for, 17 years. And our immigration lawyer tracked down where her daughter was, and she was in a Ugandan refugee camp. And he then thought about bringing the daughter under family reunion, but the rules for the Home Office, they denied family reunion because the daughter in Uganda had two children of her own. She was only, I think she was only 17 at the time. She must have been under 18. So we challenged that, and what we discovered was that the daughter in Uganda had two children, but as a victim of rape, of war. Anyway, we then finally, we won the appeal at the Home Office, represented the client, and we reunited the family, and they've all joined in the UK now. And if you hear the stories of people, you know, how can any human being not feel sympathy for somebody who has had to leave their home, their jobs, their family, and go and live in a foreign land? Most of us wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to do that. Why would anybody want to? They've been forced to. The only reason they do leave is because they're in danger of losing their lives. And as you say, the media mix them up with people who come for economic reasons. And the reality is that the only people who can really come to the UK for economic reasons are EU nationals. And now the government's stopping that anyway. So it's very, very hard to get into the UK because there are all sorts of barriers to prevent you getting here. You have carriers liability on aeroplanes, on boats, for lorries. So those carriers are fined if they take anybody who's turned to be illegal. So it's very hard to get here. And the people who do so because to stay where they are is more dangerous than to come here.
So I was thinking they did it because of the great benefits system of £5 a day.
Well, just to clarify, they are excluded from access to benefits. So somebody who just turns up as an asylum seeker, well, somebody who just turns up into the UK from a country outside the EU, let's say, are not entitled to any benefits. They're deemed to be a person subject to immigration control. If they then claim asylum, they may be able to get asylum support, which is paid at a tiny pittance, tiny, 30, I can't remember the exact amount now, about £38 or something a week.
Yeah, sounds about right.
But also only if they agree to be dispersed away from the southeast. So they have to go and live in places like Glasgow or other kind of northern cities and towns. So, again, a lot of kind of migrants would feel safer, I suppose, in London rather than other places. So it's a difficult choice, really. But it's no choice. They have to leave their home country. So yeah. The other kind of main group that we see are trafficked people. And again, you wouldn't think this happens in Harrow, but we've had quite a number of cases of women who've been trafficked and prostituted, and then when they get pregnant, they hide their pregnancy initially because otherwise they'll be forced to have the baby aborted. Mm. And what happens is when they get to more or less full term, the traffickers will take them to have their baby delivered and then sold. And we've had a number of cases of women who've escaped when they've been transported to have the baby delivered. And we've been able to get them status to remain in the country and be safe, basically.
Actually, I was going to just ask you about that. I think you've given us a bit of an illustration there, but just on a couple of details. Within our wonderful media, trafficking, economic migration and refugees, they all seem to be thrown into the one pot and getting very, very conveniently mixed up. So, you know, you hear of people saying, quite rightly, talking about people smugglers, which is a terrible trade, and I'm sure we could stop it tomorrow if we really wanted to. But, you know, I see people on a boat, they come in here from France or whatever. Is this just people trafficking? How much money have they spent? Blah, blah, blah. Again, in your experience in both in politics and in the law centre, what are the differences here, and how have you come across? Do you know anyone who's got off of a very unsafe boat because they're being trafficked? Because it seems to me like they're totally different things.
They're different things. So trafficking, people will be brought, sometimes, you know, often with trafficking, people are tricked into going somewhere. So they're offered a job. It might be in the UK or it might be in another part of Europe. And then when they get there, they are their passports taken away. And then if it's for prostitution, they may be raped. And then they'll be told that their families will be told they don't feel they can return to their families. They'll be told that the police will deport them or they won't be believed. So that's one group. And then you get people who are trafficked for other things, maybe not for prostitution. But if you see people on the trains leaving the kind of packets of tissues and things like that,
yep,
that everybody scowls at, often they're trafficked. there's lots of people trafficked for things like cannabis farms. It's usually children rather than adults. Or there are people trafficked for forced labour, really, you know, to work for a pittance, and they have their passports taken away. So that's that. And they're usually brought in, not in the way that refugees would come in. So refugees, or those seeking asylum, are different. And we have made it almost impossible for an asylum seeker to get here lawfully. They can't just get on a plane and say, I'm going to the UK to claim asylum. So they can only come by clandestine means. That's the only possibility. And this has been going on since the year dot. You know, if you think back many, many years, you know, back to people fleeing Nazi Germany, there would have been people assisting them to get out of the country and into the UK, and probably for money. So that's nothing new. I think the problem, what is new, is the measures that we take to prevent people getting in here. And so it has made it more dangerous for people. So all we need to do, if we really genuinely, if what we care about is the safety of people, then we would make it easier for people to get into the country and claim asylum and then deal with those asylum claims. And if we think they're bogus, they'll lose the claim. But we don't. We make it impossible, so that people have to take risks in the back of lorries, you know, on these tiny boats that are not safe, and how many lives are lost. But also some European countries, of course, then go out and try to destroy the boats or prevent them from actually landing. And this is Europe.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable, really. It's quite shocking.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, the civilised world. Yes.
Yeah, and then you have migrants, and migrants are people who come here to work. So they could be, you have different tiers of immigration, that some people come because they've got a specialism, often it's like in research. Other people are brought in as economic migrants to work as in the health service, for example. Other people come in as EU nationals, are the main group that come in as economic migrants. But they work. They largely work. Most migrants who come to work, work. That's what they're here for. You know? And they bring a net contribution to the economy, not a drain on the economy. They're usually kind of younger, fitter and healthier, and they work. So they're paying taxes, national insurance and everything else. And actually, we need more people who are workers to pay for our pensions when we get older. We don't have that. We have a labour shortage. So it's us. The stories are horrendous, honestly. You know,
you can imagine.
We've heard of people walking just different countries. I can't even comprehend it. You know, it just seems unbelievable to me. And so many of the people are so humble and just, you know, they're not here to take. They want safety, and that's, you know, such a kind of basic thing. Most people do not want to leave their home country. They absolutely do not. They want to live amongst their friends and their family and what they know. And it's just really sad what they have to put up with, really. And I've been working with refugees one way or another since 1989. And initially then it was with Ethiopian, Eritrean refugees. And so I have long experience with asylum seekers, refugees. And it just fills me with horror the way they are treated, have been treated for decades. So we've got a team of three immigration lawyers who are kept very busy. And as I say, that's the only immigration law they do. So asylum, trafficking, domestic violence of people who are here as a spouse, and also EU national rights. So, and they're never short of work, sadly.
Now, moving on to squatting. Now, I know we discussed before the show that there's not a lot of examples of this in Harrow per se, but I just wanted to... I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll read you a couple of bits that I've noted from... we need to do a more in-depth show about this, which I will get around to writing at some point. But it's an issue that I feel very... So I'll put my position to the listeners right now, which is... squatting is very specific and very individual. I think if someone were to break into a person's property where they live, this is an entirely different situation from the, and I'm sure London is no different from other cities around this country, nor for that matter other cities around the world, where there are a substantial amount of unused, abandoned buildings which are owned by someone who's usually using them as some kind of tax write-off. Whatever they're using them for, there's nobody in there. And I know from personal experience that it is very easy to, well, not easy, it's hard work, but it's simple, I should say, to set up any kind of homelessness relief, etc., and things like that in any of those kind of buildings. Some of you in the London area or those of you who watch our news might remember Sophia House from a couple of years ago. It was a building in Great Portland Street where an entire kind of functioning homeless centre was set up, taking in a lot of people who were needy and enduring a very, very cold winter when a lot of people were freezing to death on the streets of London. So that kind of squatting I have zero problem with, and in fact I'll go on the record and say I actively encourage it. Now, I just want to say a couple of things from the government website. There's a lot of stuff to do. And as I say, if you're interested in this, we're going to do another show, a full show on this stuff at some point in the near future. I'm sorry, I can't be more specific than that. But there's a little bit of an issue here on squatting in non-residential properties. And as I say, this is from the gov.uk site. A non-residential property is any building or land that is not designed to be lived in. Simply being on another person's non-residential property without their permission is not usually a crime. The police can take action if squatters commit other crimes when entering or staying in the property, and these crimes can include causing damage when entering the property, causing damage while in the property, not leaving when they are told to by a court. Please pay attention to that last word. Stealing from the property, using utilities like electricity or gas without permission. Okay, that's a bit of a tricky one. Fly tipping and not obeying a noise abatement notice. Pamela, on that particular part of squatting in non-residential properties, do you at the Law Centre have any experience on this, or is there anything you want to add that you know of?
No, we have very little expertise on this because we don't get many cases at all. We've had one that I know of, and that was in a residential property, unoccupied, but residential. So, I mean, what you've read out is exactly right. You know, that if you are in somebody's home, basically, it can be a criminal offence, so you can face a prison sentence or a fine. If it's in non-residential accommodation, it's not a criminal matter, but it doesn't mean that the courts won't be involved, because you could be guilty of trespass, and so whoever owns the property could just get a court order and get you out, and they could probably do it quite quickly. So I probably don't see squatting as a solution to a housing problem. But it, I think it would be an interesting area to get somebody who deals with squatting all the time, perhaps for another show. But we don't have a lot of that in Harrow at all, to be honest. We haven't had any cases, really.
Okay, well, I will contact my people, and the shout out is there for anyone who's listening. If you're know a lot about squatting, perhaps not just in the UK. I mean, we could do more than one show on this. Let me know. That would be great. Yeah. I just want to say something else on squatters' rights to property. So again, from the same website, gov.uk. A long-term squatter can become the registered owner of a property or land they've occupied without the owner's permission. In order to know more about this, get legal advice from a conveyancer or a solicitor if you are a squatter in the property and want to claim ownership. You can apply if you can prove you or a succession of squatters have occupied property continuously for 10 years. 12 years is a not a registered with the HM Land Registry.
Yeah.
You or your predecessors acted as owners of the property for the whole of that time. You or any of your predecessors do not have the owner's permission. For example, the property was not originally rented to a squatter. So more advice on that from, as it says, a conveyancer and solicitor.
It's a very small group that would apply to, I would say.
Yeah.
And I probably wouldn't go to a conveyancing solicitor. I don't think they would have... Well, I don't know. Firstly, you'd have to pay a conveyancing solicitor, so that may not be the best. I would start with a law centre as well, because even if they don't have a lot of expertise in it, the good thing is that we can get access to barristers who do. So, you know, so I would start with a law centre or a citizens' advice bureau and see what they say. Although it's quite complex, that, and it applies to only a very small group. So you probably do need specialist advice, I would say. And there's bound to be, I can't think of what they are now, but there was squatters' rights group. So they probably still exist, who would have up-to-date knowledge about all of this.
So I suppose, launching on to sort of our last part this evening, the UK right now is in the middle of a very severe economic problem, much of it related to COVID-19, but let's be honest, a lot of us saw this coming before now. Who do you think will benefit from the present and upcoming economic crisis?
The people who always benefit, the rich. I mean, they've already done so, haven't they, through some of the contracts for PPE and other things. So they're the only ones that benefit largely. And I can't see that people on, you know, the poorest are not going to benefit. We have in Harrow, I think there's 40,000 people furloughed, possibly not going to get their jobs back. Bigger companies are scaling down, aren't they? You know, you've got British Airways and a lot of the other airlines. People are losing their jobs, shops closing. And landlords even are probably not going to do that well, because, you know, tenants not able to pay and leaving or not being able to get tenants. I think it is really only the wealthy that are going to do well. They always do. I mean, it's disgraceful, the amount of deaths and the amount of cases of COVID that we've had, and possibly, you know, unnecessary deaths, and people living in fear now that they're going to be next. It's just disgraceful. From the benefit system, so universal credit that you don't get paid for 5-6 weeks, so that leaves you in a very precarious situation with your landlord. If you can't pay the rent and you've lost your job during COVID, employment rights, you know, we had so many calls. We don't even do employment law at the law centre, and I've just got funding to appoint an employment solicitor, actually, because we're so inundated. But a common call we would get would be somebody who said, I've been furloughed, but my employer wants me to do my job, and they've said I can just do this or that or whatever, and do I have to do that? And obviously the first question is, how long have you been employed? And often they've only been employed for a year, 18 months. And of course, you've got very few rights unless you've been employed for 2 years. So although you can try to assert some rights, what happens if they try to get rid of you? And trying to get another job at this time is very difficult. So a lot of employees have been exploited during this lockdown period, I would say. where employees have still been expected to work, even though the employers are getting the furlough payments. The accommodation, we've cut benefits so much, the level of housing benefit and now universal credit is set below rents. So people are forced into overcrowded accommodation. You know, it's common to see families of, say, six living in two rooms in Harrow. Mm. So, again, that's a factor with COVID. And the gig economy, so many people in Harrow work in insecure jobs, so they're forced to go to work even though they might be at risk. Again, a factor in contracting COVID. So the whole system is just like a recipe waiting, you know, a disaster waiting to happen. You could just predict it. None of us knew about COVID, but you could certainly know that something terrible would happen with this situation eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that, effectively speaking, capitalism is over for the majority of people? It's just finally failed the last time. I never like to say this because it's a tempting fate. Capitalism can always fail that little bit more. But I wonder if it's a bit like Paul Mason's notions of post-capitalism. I mean, are we in a position now where there's absolutely nothing we can get out of this system anymore?
Well, capitalism works very well for some, doesn't it? But only for a very few people. For very few. And the problem is it doesn't work for the rest of us, you know. And so for the majority, it doesn't. But whilst you have the few that have so much power, it's unlikely to change. And, you know, people have the right to vote and should exercise that right. It's very difficult. I think people are so bogged down with just trying to get by and living and surviving that they've got little time for anything else, to mobilise, to organise. Because if you're working three jobs and you get home, you're probably not going to think about going to a demonstration or a political meeting or something, or organising a tenants' rights group or, you know, an unemployed workers group or something. But really, it probably is what's needed for people to mobilise and organise, to take back a bit of control. And obviously that came in the past from unions. But again, with the kind of gig economy, there's perhaps less people in unions, or they feel that they can't afford the union dues, so they don't join. But I think over the period of COVID, there's been a surge in union membership, which is a good sign. Few good things that's come out of COVID. It's forced many of us to become more IT proficient. So, you know, working from home or having meetings through Zoom or Teams, I think you're absolutely right that it will be kind of easier to do that in the future because we've all got quite used to it now, or lots of us have. So that's the one good thing, probably. I mean, what we did, so we have a young person's solicitor and we've got a victims of crime barrister. Okay. And what we did over the summer was to put on, we've done physical meetings like this in the past, which is what to do if you're stopped by the police. And the meeting we had where people were able to attend, which was last year, was really well attended. And we had barristers who were going through and talking. So what rights do the police have to stop you? What rights do you have? What information do you have to give? How to behave, how not to behave? And it was really successful. So we did a remote one last, I think, 2 weeks ago. And we're going to be doing one on county lines soon to see the people involved as victims rather than, you know, criminals, which is what our young people are being criminalised. But we try to kind of do that public legal education as well to reach out to people so that they understand what their rights are.
Yeah, so thanks again, Pound for Expansion, for appearing on All The Rage. You're always welcome here. Wonderful information. And we hope to speak to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, John. Thanks, Dave.
All The Rage with John Bowd. www.traxfm.org